ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If I had to pick one word to describe America's history in the Middle East, I'd probably go with mistake.
But it was, the Americans believe, all a dreadful mistake.
The backpackers crossed the poorly marked border by mistake.
The war in Iraq was a big, fat mistake.
So why is it happening again? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we actually try to learn from the world's mistakes. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Frustrations boiled over at the ARN Media annual shareholders meeting, with owners voicing anger at the performance of the company in recent years and its messy divorce from two of its biggest stars. Meanwhile, the price of oil has dropped, with markets seeming to pull from never-ending reserves of hope that the Strait of Hormuz is soon to open. So what should we make of these market moves? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Alicia Barry, ABC finance reporter and host of The Business on Thursdays.
Good morning, Alicia. Thank you for joining us early. You're usually spending your time prepping for the telly, where people will be able to see you on The Business later today. But you've joined us here in the pod studio, so good to have you.
It's lovely to be here, Carrington.
Let's turn our attention to ARN Media. This was there was a lot of anticipation about this meeting. Usually media companies do not like to be the ones in the headlines, but they have found themselves in the headlines for the last few months because of this very messy fallout with two of its biggest stars. This is Kyle Sandilands and Jackie Henderson, better known as Kyle and Jackie O. Now, they used to be the dominant force in Sydney breakfast radio. They signed this mammoth deal that would have seen them be contracted to the company for 10 years. They also tried to go and conquer Melbourne. That was less successful. And now we have this court action playing out in the backdrop of this ARN shareholders meeting. First of all, what's the state of play as you see it when it comes to ARN? And then talk us through what we've seen at the shareholders meeting.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it seems as though time has caught up with Kyle and Jackie O. If you look at the full year accounts, revenue is down across metro and regional. And of course, as you say, their foray into Melbourne was an absolute flop. The only space where the company is making money is in the digital space. Revenue was up 7%. But if you look at their accounts for the full year, revenue is down 10%. So this is really hemorrhaging money. And they were going to pay these guys $200 million over 10 years combined. They're 2 years into this contract. And maybe it comes as a blessing to ARN that they don't have to pay, at least at the moment, it's in the courts, this money out to these megastars. It's a big fall from grace for Kyle and Jackie O, but if you look at the time when Kyle and Jackie O signed the contract with ARN around November 2023, ARN's shares were 90 cents. Today, they're around 26 cents. And over the course of just this year, the shares are down 34%. So it is no surprise that shareholders are unhappy, to say the least. And today at the company's annual general meeting, as you say, Carrington, they've had a chance to voice their anger with a 90% vote against the new CEO, Michael Stevenson's salary. That's the remuneration report. This happens at every general meeting. And it's his salary was set at $1.1 million plus around $2.5 million of incentives, I believe. So this 90% vote against this remuneration report is just a big indication that shareholders are not happy.
Casting our minds back to when Kyle and Jackie O first came over to ARN. So they were previously with Southern Cross Media through the Today Network here in Sydney. They were huge stars, but they couldn't come to an agreement about how much they thought they were worth versus how much their previous employer thought they were worth. They sign on and effectively brought their entire audience along with them. They rebranded the station here to KIIS, and they really were the powerhouses behind ARN's success. And that's why we saw them sign this huge deal. I mean, these were extraordinary numbers even at the time, though I think with the benefit now of hindsight, they were numbers that were not going to be sustained in a fragmenting media market. And so this is messy. The board did not want to talk too much about this because they said it is before the courts, and you can understand that argument. But yes, that question fundamentally, at the time that they signed this contract, there was champagne popping. This was a huge celebration about locking in their two biggest stars for a very long period. This was supposed to underpin the financial success of the network. And yet now it does look like perhaps they became too big a cost to carry. And there was a lot of behind the scenes, but also some of it public, action against the network when it came to advertising dollars. And a really orchestrated campaign going after Kyle and Jackie O for some of the more controversial commentary. And what we hear from the ARN board is that actually it was hurting their bottom line, that they weren't getting the advertising dollars that they thought they should be getting.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, this brand damage from the unsafe behavior that has occurred on the radio station has meant that advertisers have walked away. I mean, I dipped into this annual general meeting for about 10 minutes or so, and I heard the chairman, Hamish McLennan, speaking. Look, he sounded like he was at a funeral. I don't know if that was a deliberate attempt to sort of be contrite given the state of the company, or if he genuinely was feeling very downbeat. But it wasn't a joyous occasion, that's
this
for sure.
This wasn't a pep talk. This wasn't a man talking about the exciting opportunities coming. This is somebody who seemed kind of on the defensive.
Absolutely. And so there was a few investors asking questions. One was about whether or not advertising revenue was going to return. One of the directors said they were really hopeful that this brand damage could be put behind the company and they would see these advertisers return this financial year or next. But when you look at the revenue, $285 million in the full year, they were going to pay Kyle and Jackie O $200 million over 10 years. You can see how these numbers aren't really adding up.
And perhaps you could have argued at the time that the contract was signed that if you could take this breakfast program national and you had the same kind of numbers around the nation that you were seeing in Sydney, then perhaps you can justify spending $200 million on these two stars over 10 years. The problem was it hadn't worked in Melbourne, obviously the other big metro market for them. There was obviously therefore questions about whether or not this was a product that you could move across the rest of the country. And traditionally, it's very hard to get breakfast radio to work around the country. Most people want to hear their local insights from people who are living in the same city as them and interacting with them. And so I think, unfortunately, if that was the model, it came a cropper. Now, obviously, there is the dispute between Kyle and Jackie O, this very public falling out of two people who've worked together for so many years and had been very close. They're both taking legal action to try to get paid out for their contracts. Obviously, ARN is trying to defend that position because that would be a massive blow to them. But they also need to just put this behind them, don't they? They need to come up with, well, who is going to take over this breakfast program going forward? Because this is the way you start your day, and this has always been the most important program for any individual radio station. And the fact that this is still playing out in the courts and they don't know who's going to take over is a difficult predicament to be in.
Absolutely, when you're trying to secure advertisers, right? But also it plays to a much broader issue, I would argue, in the media sector, and that is the fragmentation. I mean, Carrington, you and I are on a podcast right now. People can play this anytime they would like. So are people still listening to that one radio station in the morning when they get in the car? Are they getting in the car? You know, are they walking to work with AirPods in their ears? I mean, ARN is sort of banking its growth opportunity in the digital space. Mm. It's pointed to that outlook and it says the convergence of audio and video creates a material opportunity. So they're going to start filming their programs. They're going to start doing more podcasts. Is this big flagship radio breakfast program what they're going to hang their hat on in the next couple of years?
Because it's sucking up a lot of resources that could otherwise be deployed to other parts of the program. Obviously, the hope is that you can leverage off those stars in your stable and use them across other platforms. But obviously, those numbers weren't stacking up. Now, again, the current position, I believe, from ARN is that the reason they terminated the contracts with their two big stars was because they couldn't work together any longer. Jackie said she felt unsafe. This is all contested, and this is why it's going through this legal process. But you can see how they are trying to walk a very fine line, because they have to explain to shareholders, how are you going to turn this company around? Where are you going to find growth? But they have to be careful what they're saying, because you have this legal case still happening in the background.
Yeah, and they really wouldn't talk about it at the AGM. Any question that was thrown to them about Kyle or Jackie O was very quickly put to bed, because it is before the courts. And in fact, there was a brief mention in Hamish McLennan's opening address, but then said, we're not going to talk about it anymore. I mean, the big issue now for the company is they have a first strike against the remuneration report. It just takes 25% of shareholders to vote against a remuneration report for it to be a first strike. This was 90%. If they do get a second strike, and that would be at the next AGM next year, then there is a spill motion for the board put to shareholders, and then shareholders have to vote 50% in favour of this. So whilst Hamish McLennan has been voted in favour of being returned as one of the motions, I mean, the board's on notice here.
Yeah, that's right. He was clearly re-elected. There wasn't a move to ouster him. But the fact that they are voting against the remuneration report, which is one of the most important aspects of what the board does show that shareholders aren't happy with the way that the business is being run, at least in part, and they are on notice to try to turn this around. It is a difficult environment. We know lots of media companies in Australia are really struggling. We've had major changes in the ownership of some of Australia's biggest media companies, like Southern Cross and Seven coming together. There is a lot of shakeouts happening at the moment that we're seeing job cuts over at Nine. You know, this is a difficult environment, but the messiness of this divorce from their big two stars is obviously a big part of the reason why people are so focused on it. Let's talk about a different type of messiness, which is what is happening on global markets. Again, another very volatile week when it comes to oil prices. It has moved up and down, as it has been over the last 2 months, with Donald Trump's different utterances about what is happening with the war. Now, he has said, or there seems to be moves afoot for peace talks to be reignited, a one-page memorandum of understanding perhaps in the works that Iran is now looking at. Is there any reason to believe this will be different than the other times during this war where it looks like a peace agreement is about to be struck? Are you feeling as optimistic as the market seems to be?
I mean, we've been watching this since the 28th of February, right? And it keeps playing out in exactly the same way. It gets exhausting as a finance reporter. I mean, my husband will say to me, hope is not a strategy. But I think for the markets in this case, it certainly is the strategy. Look, I was speaking with Steve Johnson a couple of weeks ago. He's the chief investment officer and founder of Forager Investments. He said, you can't sit around and wait until this is all over and then buy cheap stocks.
Right.
Right? So perhaps investors are really hoping that there'll be a quick resolution, and they don't want to be out of the market, because once that resolution occurs, it's going to be at the top, right? So they don't want to miss out on those gains. But it's hard to see how this is going to play well for the economy. And then you have to think, well, is the index the economy? There is a huge disconnect between what's happening on the financial markets, particularly if you look at Wall Street. It is running up. It's at records again. And then, I mean, look, this week we've been talking about interest rates really hurting people. So the way that you kind of marry these two things, what's happening in the economy and how just stocks just keep rallying, it's really difficult to kind of, you know,
get your head around,
yeah.
Right? Like there seems to be an inherent inconsistency that we still have a war. Maybe it's in ceasefire. Donald Trump sometimes declares that the war is over. Sometimes he says it's about to be over. But there is a major interruption to the supply of energy around the globe. And yet we're seeing the S&P 500, the major benchmark in the United States, hitting record highs. The NASDAQ composite is on an absolute tear. I think part of the reason for this disconnect is that investors have become accustomed to the TARCO trade, as we were speaking about a lot more at the start of this conflict. But it is something that keeps recurring, that people believe at the end of the day, Donald Trump will do what is best for the markets because he sees that as a barometer of his own political fortunes. And so he wants the stock market to be going up, and therefore he wants to find an off-ramp. And the other obviously big theme this year besides the conflict is artificial intelligence and the huge profits that some of these tech companies are already experiencing, plus the huge amount of investment that's still to come in that space. And so I think investors are looking at these numbers, and by some metrics, the market is cheaper than it was late last year because of the huge earnings forecasts that these companies are giving to the market and saying they're expecting to be minting huge amounts of money. And that's why we're also seeing a bit of a disconnect between what's happening on the Australian stock market versus what's happening in the US. And the US really it's almost in a world of its own. You can argue South Korea is also riding that wave as well because of its high exposure to chips. But because of the concentration of artificial intelligence companies in the United States, they are receiving these huge increases in their valuations that you're not seeing in other parts of the global stock markets, including Australia and Europe. And so they are, yes, we take our lead from what's happening on Wall Street, but the Australian market is not performing as strongly as it.
Well, no. And that has everything to do with what you just said, Carrington, the concentration. If you look at the tech concentration in the US, I mean, it's about 32% of the index made up by these mega cap tech stocks, and investors are buying the growth story. I mean, there have been some concerns that these tech companies are spending too much, but there's still so much baked into them returning on that investment.
Yeah.
People want to buy that growth story still. It's not good.
There's been a couple of little hints, like Meta's last update when it seemed that there was a little bit more cynicism about if it was spending too much when it came to artificial intelligence, but then a company like Alphabet, the parent company of Google.
And Microsoft.
It seems like the more the better when it comes to a company like Alphabet, right? That if the more money they're saying that they're pumping into artificial intelligence, the more they are rewarded by the market.
That's right. But if you contrast the gains that we're seeing in the US with what we're seeing in Australia, I mean, the NASDAQ is up about 13% this year, I think, from memory. If we look at the Australian share market, it's up about 3%, 4%, I think. But our tech sector compared to the US, it's about 6%. We do have some big names like WiseTech.
Zero, NextDC, which is actually a play that is connected to the artificial intelligence investment.
On the data centers.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we do have a few, as I said, about 6% or so, but it is really minor in comparison to what's going on in the US. And I mean, of course, the US is a much larger economy. Our market is really dominated by banks, miners, and supermarkets.
And they're not necessarily riding this wave of innovation. I mean,
CBA sometimes
exactly.
is put in that camp.
The finance companies, the big banks are investing heavily in their own internal processes when it comes to artificial intelligence, but they're not necessarily making money in the same direct way that we're seeing these big tech companies. We've had multiple questions this week following the Reserve Bank's decision to hike interest rates. And I think if we kind of crunch it down, the fundamental question is, we keep hearing from the Reserve Bank, they have one blunt instrument to deal with inflation. Well, why aren't there other options? So our colleague Michael Yander has a great article, which people can find on ABC website today, where he goes through some of the other options potentially of how you can deal with high inflation outside just pushing up interest rates. What do you make of that fundamental question and some of the suggestions that we've got from Michael?
Yeah, Carrington, I mean, we heard our colleague Amelia Turzon put that question to the RBA governor after the rates decision on Tuesday. What tools beyond interest rates can the RBA use so that it's not hurting regular people? And you can understand the frustration in the community. I mean, this interest rate tool really does hit people who have mortgages, those who are renters, not those who have paid off their mortgages. And it's about 60% of the population in those two camps that are really being hurt by this. unless you go and fundamentally rewrite the architecture of monetary policy, which Michelle Bullock could not do on Tuesday, the RBA really does only have one tool, and it is a monetary policy tool, which is interest rates. When we look at what the government can do, fiscal policy, I mean, a lot of heavy lifting has been left to the RBA. And as Michael Yander points to, it's much easier for governments politically to stimulate growth. They can do that in many ways. And we have seen it with, you know, the reduction to the fuel excise that's made it cheaper for people to buy petrol in this environment. But do they want to take money out of the economy? Well, probably not really if they want to stay in government. I mean, it's a hard sell. But also, as Michelle Bullock pointed to on Tuesday, when governments do make changes, it's not very immediate. It usually has to be legislated and it takes time before they can roll it out. And then it's probably not quite as direct. Monetary policy is a pretty direct tool. It goes straight to the bank accounts of Australians. Mm. Might take a few months to work through, but it happens.
Michael's got a few suggestions of what you could do. One is that you have some sort of independent agency that is able to adjust tax rates when inflation is getting too hot. So you up the tax rate because most people are pay-as-you-go taxpayers, that you would immediately see that if you're getting paid fortnightly, you'd see a slight reduction in your pay packet. So this would hit all taxpayers almost immediately.
Not those who don't earn a salary.
Not those who don't earn a salary, exactly. And of course, the question becomes, who is doing that? Would people prefer that than seeing their mortgage repayments go up? There's a there's a fairness question there. And who would be the ones making that setting? He also points out there's a legal question about whether or not those powers can be given away by the parliament effectively to some sort of outside agency. Another suggestion would be that you increase superannuation payments during a period of high inflation. So the mandatory amount that goes from your pay packet to your superannuation account, you increase that. So that means instead of the money just going into general revenue for tax, that you would have more money in your superannuation account for when you retire. He also points out that perhaps that money could be used actually to stimulate the economy, which actually might run opposite its aim, because those superannuation funds would be using the money and putting them into investments, might be forcing up the cost, the value of assets, etc.
And these suggestions would work alongside the RBA, so they wouldn't be in replace of it. And I think this goes to the heart of sort of the idea of fiscal policy then working alongside monetary policy. So these bodies or the tax idea would obviously have to be legislated, created by government. Then you don't just have central banks doing all the work on inflation. But it's not a quick fix, Carrington.
No, and Michelle Bullock, the Reserve Bank governor, did get asked about whether or not it was better in the olden days, where perhaps the government was expected to take more of the take up more of the slack when it came to fighting inflation. And she didn't seem to think necessarily that was the case.
I mean, that is a big question. Is the central bank the best institution to be bringing down inflation? Well, they're the one with the bluntest tool.
And they're the ones who have been doing it. And there is a reason. I understand why people want there to be another answer. Mm. People want there to be a kind of pain-free way of bringing down inflation without people feeling the pain. But unfortunately, that mechanism, the pain, is part of the solution
and,
at the moment.
I mean, it's simply demand destruction.
Exactly.
And that means you don't have as much money to spend. So unfortunately, it is the pain that Australians are going to have to feel. But when the Reserve Bank talks about demand destruction, they're talking in aggregate. It's not being felt in aggregate. It's being felt very, very acutely in some pockets and very minutely by other people.
And that's when perhaps the government has a role in trying to make sure that the damage isn't being felt by just certain groups and not others. But that is a political question.
And a bigger one than we can answer today.
And we will find out from the government next week when they hand down the budget exactly what they think the appropriate settings are, whether or not there needs to be cost of living support at this time, or whether or not they're trying to dial back government spending in order to take some of the demand out of the economy. That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode of Fuelcast in the morning. Then be sure to catch That's Business with Alan Kohler, who will be sitting down with bigger CEO Pete Finlay tomorrow afternoon. And remember, to never miss an episode, make sure you're following ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Alicia.
See you, Carrington.